Okay, thanks, Yossi. And yeah, good morning, everyone. I'm going to ask, I hope you can all hear me okay, but I'm going to ask what seems like an odd question in this paper. And that is, I want to pose the question, can Bourdieu's social theory be mobilised to understand our recent and ongoing global economic crisis? This might seem like a really odd question to ask on lots of different fronts, not least because Bourdieu's work is rarely, if ever, called upon to engage strictly economic processes and formations. And that's the case despite the fact that he spent a whole volume explicating what he termed the social structures of the economy, and that in his later, more polemical work, he directly engaged with the political economy of neoliberalism. Yet while that's the case, Bourdieu's social theory is widely critiqued for its lack of traction in regard to economic processes, not least because of its inability to grasp the specificity of capitalist economic relations. So Craig Calhoun, for example, has argued that despite the emphasis we find in Bourdieu on the forms of capital, that's usually the thing that people are most attracted to, nonetheless, what is striking is that nowhere in Bourdieu do we find an elaboration of the specificity of capitalist capital. So while Bourdieu understands the various capitals he describes as comprising accumulated labour, he fails to specify what differentiates capitalist capital from that labour. And more particularly, Bourdieu fails to elaborate the process of abstraction and quantification of labour into units of labour of time. That is, he fails to elaborate the process of the conversion of labour into exchangeable equivalents, which is, of course, both paradigmatic of and specific to capitalist social relations. So whereas in Marx, capital is understood as homogeneous abstract units of labour time, in Bourdieu it's simply understood as accumulated labour or congealed labour. Now, understanding capital in that way, Calhoun claims, will never allow us to capture the specificity of capitalist capital, since it's unable to grasp the extraordinary levels of convertibility encountered in capitalism. Levels of convertibility which are precisely constituted in that process of the production of abstract universal equivalents. Now, given this apparent failure on the part of Bourdieu to confront the processes of capitalist accumulation, it's perhaps of little surprise that his general theoretical resources have not been put to use to engage recent economic events. This is especially so when we consider that our current economic crisis is widely understood, although I should say I think wrongly, to concern a crisis of capitalism. Indeed, to concern a reaching of the limit point of neoliberal accumulation. In this context, we therefore might reasonably ask, what possible use is a social theory which fails to specify the dynamics of capitalism for understanding a crisis in those very dynamics? And inasmuch as a crisis always implies social change and movement, we might add to this and ask, what use is a social theory which is concerned not so much with crisis or change, but predominantly with stasis, for coming to terms with events which have been described by Mary Poovey as involving catastrophic generic change. Yet despite the range of objections that might be raised in relation to thinking the economic crisis with and through Bourdieu, and there's lots more that I could go into, but I've just raised some there, it's my contention in this paper that in Bourdieu we can in fact find important resources for this task. The usefulness and relevance of these resources may, however, only be made explicit if we understand these events as concerning a reworking of time. An understanding which positions Bourdieu's understanding of temporality as rich and provocative, not only in regard to understanding recent economic events, but also for considering questions of economic futures. So, this paper then concerns two interventions, The first is the claim that recent economic events should be understood in terms of temporality or time, and especially a restructuring of time. And the second is that in Bourdieu we find surprising resources to help us understand or elaborate that restructuring. Now, to lay out these two interventions, it's necessary, first of all, that I turn to the issue of time, and in particular the place of time in recent economic events. Now, a frequently rehearsed account of the actions and dealings which sparked our current global economic recession turns on a particular and normative account of time. This is an account where traders, dealers, and financial capital more generally are positioned as engaging in an activity that should not have taken place, namely trading in the future at the expense of the present. So, in a recent special issue of Subjectivity, Adams et al., for example, suggests that our current global economic recession was sparked by finance capital's delirious trade in futures and risks. A trade which makes violently plain that our current moment is defined by a state of anticipation. That is a thinking and living towards the future. The related credit-led financialization of everyday life has also been understood in similar terms. That is, as compelling forms of life and ways of being which are orientated towards and hinging upon uncertain futures. Thus, for example, consumers mortgaging their futures in the form of indebtedness to secure commodities in the here and now, farmers obtaining credit for what might happen to their crops, company and organisational valuations, not on the grounds of present assets, but on the grounds of events yet to come, and calculations of the value of workers and workforces, not on the basis of their existing skills, experiences and capabilities, but on their potential ability. That is, on their ability to deal with events which have yet to take place, are all cited as evidence of the emergence of anticipatory ways of life. So, like the financial dealers trading in virtual and actual futures, such anticipatory life forms are generally understood in no uncertain terms as negative. So Adams et al., for example, exposed such a negativity via a set of reflections on strategies of refusal in regard to anticipation, while Richard Sennett, discussing that shift from existing skill sets to potential ability, argues that that shift deprives people of a sense of narrative movement, that is, of the accumulation of experience and connections between events in time. It also, he argues, eschews sensate impressions, divides analysing from believing, ignores the glue of emotional attachment, and penalises digging deep. Now, I'll return to that issue of the severing of connections between events in time, as well as to the eschewing of sensate impressions. And for now, I want to suspend any judgment regarding the imperative to anticipate. Instead, it first seems important to focus on the version of time which such accounts enact. For these are accounts which place the politics of time and issues of temporality at the heart of our contemporary moment, a positioning of time which a range of writers from a number of disciplines appear to agree. Yet accounts of increasingly anticipatory forms of life also carry with them a further set of assumptions regarding time. These include the assumption that the future should be at some distance from the present, or that there should be some kind of boundary between the present and the future. The conjecture that the future can and should be protected via prudent action in the here and now. The assumption that the future should not be traded as a resource, in other words, that it shouldn't be commodified in some way, and the supposition that the future should not determine the present. Most significantly, from the point of view of my concerns here, these accounts share two linked assumptions. First, that they assume that the present, or more precisely, a certain version of the present, one in which, and on Sennett's account, experience can be accumulated and connections made between events in time, is being destroyed by a certain relationship to the future, namely by this injunction to anticipate. Secondly, they assume that the injunction towards thinking and living the future is one which is relatively new, or at the very least is one that's intensified in our current moment. Yet many of these, frankly, normative assumptions about time are challenged by many sociological accounts of temporality. While not particularly celebrated for his work on time, nevertheless, in Bourdieu we can find such challenges, especially in his insistence that the future is not a contingent possibility, a possible which may or may not happen, or a distant horizon separated from the present, but is already present in our immediate present, a future which is already here. As I've elaborated elsewhere, for Bourdieu, the future is already present in our immediate presence because agents are ordinarily immersed in the forthcoming, or more precisely, agents practically and pre-reflexively anticipate the forthcoming as a routine part of action. Put differently, the future is already present in the immediate present because practice for Bourdieu and following Husserl is pro-tensive in character. Indeed, Bourdieu suggests that a pre-reflexive, unconscious aiming at the forthcoming is the most common form of the experience of time, although this experience is itself paradoxical, since like that of the self-evidence of the familiar world, time usually doesn't offer itself to be felt or sensed, and for the large part passes unnoticed. For Bourdieu, therefore, and interestingly, time, for the most part, is unexperienced. This ordinary practical anticipation of the forthcoming, Bourdieu suggests, is particularly clear in the case of emotions, where the body sees the forthcoming, the oncoming car or the threatening dog, as something already there, as irremediable. In such instances, Bourdieu describes how the body is snatched by the forthcoming of the world. Yet beyond these instances of fear, Bourdieu claims that similar processes are at work for mundane action. In a game of football, for example, a good player does not position herself or himself where the ball is, but where the ball is about to land. In this instance, the forthcoming is not simply a possible, but it's already present in the configuration of the game, including the present positions and postures of teammates and opponents. For Bourdieu, the inscription of the future in the immediate present, or the presence of the forthcoming in the configuration of the game, is, however, not a simple given of practice, but is constituted in the relationship between habitus and social world, and more precisely, in the relationship between habitus and the tendencies of social fields. As is by now very well rehearsed, for Bourdieu, fields are only fully viable if their logics are durably embedded in the dispositions of agents operating within them. Or, and to put this slightly differently, are only viable if the unconscious and pre-reflexive dispositions, habits, and schemes of agents are aligned with the objective principles of fields. Such schemes, Bourdieu writes, are the products of incorporation of the structures and tendencies of the world and make it possible to adapt endlessly to partially modified contexts and to construct the situation as a complex whole endowed with meaning in a practical operation of quasi-bodily anticipation of the immediate tendencies of fields. So in other words, it's that we are incorporated in the world, that the dispositions of agents are open to the very structures of the world, which enables this pre-reflexive, routine, practical anticipation of the future. Now, this understanding of time and temporalization raises some critical challenges, I think, to accounts of increasingly anticipatory ways of life. At least four issues stand out here. First, Bourdieu's clear insistence that ordinary action is anticipatory and that the future is already inscribed in the immediate present raises questions around the assumption, found in accounts of increasingly anticipatory ways of life that the injunction to anticipate is relatively new and specific to our present moment. For inasmuch as ordinary action is necessarily anticipatory, how can it be claimed that action attuned to the forthcoming is specific to the present? Second, Bourdieu's understanding of the inscription of the forthcoming in the immediate present surely also questions the assumption found in accounts of the injunction to anticipate, that the present is being undercut or destroyed by the future. For if, as Bourdieu claims, the forthcoming is always and necessarily inscribed in the present, if our present contains the future, how can it be claimed that the forthcoming can undercut and destabilize the present? How, for example, can the forthcoming undercut the accumulation of experience and compromise connections between events in time if the forthcoming is inscribed in those very practices? Third, Bourdieu's account of time also must surely make us question the normative assumptions in accounts of the injunction to anticipate that the future should somehow be at a distance from the present, and the proper sequencing of time is one in which the present precedes the future. For if the forthcoming is already present in the configuration of the game, how can such claims be upheld? Yet perhaps the most important challenge that Bourdieu's account of time raises to accounts of increasingly anticipatory ways of life is the insistence that time is not an entity which simply passes. More specifically for Bourdieu, time is not a simple medium through which or vessel in which events take place, and nor does time operate externally to subjects and their actions. For far from practice simply taking place in time, for Bourdieu, practice makes time. In short, Bourdieu insists that practice is temporalization. This insistence is of some significance when we consider that in accounts of increasingly anticipatory ways of life, time and events, or time and practice, tend to be separated out. So, for example, in Sennett's account of the undercutting of the present by the forthcoming, the present under threat is one in which connections can and should be made between events in time. That is, a present in which time operates and proceeds externally to events. Yet for Bourdieu, events or practice do not take place in time, but make time. As we have seen, the future, for example, is not separate from an external horizon to practice, but, and inasmuch as agents are endowed with a habitus adjusted to the field, is routinely constituted in practice. And while we can make use of Bourdieu to problematize the idea of a present in which time is external to events, the very notion of practice as temporalization also makes it clear that the futures are issues in accounts of increasing anticipation, including the traded, mortgaged, and contracted futures at issue in the global financial crisis, are not pre-existing blocks of yet-to-come time, which have been wrongly subjected to certain practices, such as trading, contracting, and mortgaging, and so on, as critics of the injunction to anticipate tend to assume. While critics of anticipatory life forms not only assume the latter, but also that the future is and should be a separate horizon from present practices and events, Bourdieu's notion of practice as temporalization alerts us to the fact that the traded, contracted, and mortgaged futures at issue in the global financial crisis were actually made in the present. In fact, are made in the very practices of trading, contracting, and mortgaging. But Bourdieu's account of practice as temporalization does more than problematize the idea that the future has been or can be traded, and by implication that the recent financial crisis concerns such a trading. For it also highlights a further normative assumption at work in critiques of the injunction to anticipate. Specifically, Bourdieu's injunction that to perform practical acts is precisely to temporalize, that is, to make time. And the recent and the implications for this injunction for recent economic events, namely that practices such as trading, mortgaging, and contracting do not stand outside of time or colonize existing futures, but make those futures, make clear that critics of the injunction to anticipate are also objecting to the entanglement of economic practices with issues of time and demanding that those two be separated. Indeed, we might speculate that the desire to separate out present and future on the part of such critics precisely concerns the demand that those two are disentangled. Yet in response to such a demand to separate out economic practice from time, we might, following Bourdieu, point out that economic practice, and in as much, of course, as it is practice, is always entangled with time. A point made particularly clear by the case of industrial capitalist production, where time was money. Specifically, for capitalist industrial production, not only did rates of profit relate to rates of speed in production, where doing things faster and more efficiently produced increases in profits, but those rates are measured in and as units of clock time. That is, in abstract, quantitative, homogenized, and reversible units of the clock. Indeed, for the case of capitalist industrial production, not only are rates of profit and production measured in such units, but such time is hegemonic. It is, moreover, precisely measurement in terms of abstract units of the clock which enables the exponential rates of exchange specific to industrial capitalism, noted by Calhoun in his critique of Bourdieu's understanding of capital. Specifically, the abstraction and quantification of labour into units of the clock, or the conversion of labour into exchangeable abstract equivalents, is the precise process which enables exponential rates of exchange, a conversion which allows the extraction of surplus from human labour. So far from being disentangled from economic practice, time is therefore clearly central to and for such practice, an entanglement which is made dramatically clear by the case of industrial capitalism. Yet while we might posit, following Bourdieu, that economic practice will always concern temporalization, and while the case of industrial capitalism clearly demonstrates the entanglement of economic practice with time, nonetheless, and in a rather paradoxical fashion, the case of industrial capitalism is also of some significance for and raises important challenges to Bourdieu's theorization of time. So as we have seen for Calhoun, Bourdieu's failure to grasp the process of abstraction, the conversion of living labour into abstract and quantifiable units of time, specific to capitalist capital, is ultimately a failure to confront the dynamics of capitalism. But we might add to this and say that Bourdieu's general failure to elaborate the hegemony of clock time for the case of industrial capitalism, along with a failure to specify the operations and characteristics of that time, not only leads to a failure to confront the dynamics of capitalism, but also confounds his insistence that time should not be understood as operating externally to subjects and their actions as a thing with which we have a relationship of externality, that of a subject facing an object. And this is so because as a form of time, clock time is one arranged exogenously to practices and events, acting paradigmatically as an external measure of events, witnessed in measures such as production rates and targets, profit ratios and predictions, working days and working break lengths. And it does such measuring in abstract, quantitative, reversible, homogeneous units. Contrary to Bourdieu's understanding of temporalization as practice, in clock time, phenomena and time are, in other words, separated out. Bourdieu's failure to recognize and elaborate that hegemony operations and characteristics of clock time for industrial capitalism not only, therefore, limit the ability of his social theory to engage the dynamics and specificities of capitalism, but also, and inasmuch as clock time operates externally to the events that it attempts to measure, throws his account of time, of practice as temporalization, into radical doubt. So we have then, or at least appear to have, a set of contradictions in regard to Bourdieu's understanding of time in general, and in regard to time and economic practice more specifically. On the one hand, his understanding of practice as temporalization helpfully enables us to cut through and problematize many normative assumptions regarding time. For example, that time should flow in one direction or another, or that there should be a certain sequencing of time. Bourdieu's understanding that anticipation is a mundane feature of practice also warns that a degree of caution may be required around the claim that ways of life are increasingly anticipatory. The notion of practice as temporalization also enables us to problematize the view that economic practices should and can be held at a distance from time. Indeed, to problematize the view heard from all manner of voices in regard to the global financial crisis and its aftermath, that the future can be colonized, traded, or commodified. For as I've argued here, Bourdieu's social theory helps us to understand that far from existing at a distance from economic presence, futures, including financial futures, are made in practices such as mortgaging, trading, and contracting. Yet while Bourdieu's social theory enables us to develop these kinds of insights, on the other hand, we might reasonably ask to what extent are they destabilized by his sidestepping of the issue of clock time and its hegemonic status in industrial capitalism. Does the bracketing of an abstract and externalist form of time, one that is at the very core and of the logic and dynamics of capitalist accumulation, mean that Bourdieu's social theory is set to remain a rather blunt instrument in regard to capitalist economic practice? But while it might be correct to state that Bourdieu ignored and bracketed the hegemony of the clock, the relationship between time and contemporary economic practices suggests that this bracketing might not be entirely fatal. Not least because in post-Fordist economic practices, suggest an end to the hegemony of clock time and the emergence of a form of time in the economic field which is more akin to Bourdieu's, namely one which is not simply a vessel for events, but one where time and events proceed together. Consider, for example, the case of financial prediction. For many, the latter and related practices, such as economic forecasting and foreseeing, are increasingly blunt instruments, not least because of the novel forms of value unfolding in post-Fordist regimes of production, which are not easily captured by such devices. Indeed, our recent financial crisis, widely reported as unpredicted and unexpected, that is, as not amenable to instruments of prediction and foreseeing, suggests that this view may well hold water. Yet we can modify this view when we consider that in practices such as prediction and forecasting, the relationship between time and events is not necessarily fixed and is open to change and flux. In a recent discussion of a specific predictive financial instrument, namely the yield curve of the US Treasury, Caitlin Zaloom makes this shift in relation between time and events particularly clear. Specifically, she charts a shift in relationship between time and money, one where rather than standing outside of events, mapping and measuring the value of money, time is increasingly fused or entangled with money or events. In short, rather than acting as an external measure of events, as we encounter paradigmatically in clock time, in practices associated with this yield curve, time unfolds with events. As Zalum explains it, the yield curve of the US Treasury maps US bonds' future value and is a widely used indicator of economic strength, both in the US and internationally. The curve is a device for understanding risk and time in the US Treasury market, and it does so by mapping Treasury yields. That is the relationship between interest rates and the time to maturity of a bond. A mapping which offers a way to understand the market's collective assessment of the future. Zalum describes how while yield curve analysis had existed in the 1960s, its significance emerged in the 70s and 80s. That is, during a period of major transformation in global finance, including the floating of US currencies and interest rates on the open market. So rather than being fixed by the US government, the market began to set the prices of dollars, bonds, and interest rates. Before this shift, Zalum goes on, bonds had been dealt with as discrete packages of time, with traders being assigned to separate markets in 2, 5, and 10-year bond. So for a 2-year bond, for example, traders bought and sold the security, looking at the risk that lay in the economy to the point of the bond's expiration. So those bonds moved in time. In short, and while Zalum herself doesn't explain it in these terms, when the prices of dollars, bonds, and interest rates were fixed, time and bonds were held as separate entities, so the bonds moved in and through time, with time acting as an external measure of yield and bond duration. During the 70s, however, the increasing deregulation of financial markets, and especially market price setting, shifted the relationship between time and money. Specifically, instead of acting as an external measure of financial objects, time became part of those very objects and an object or an event in and of itself. Zalum describes, for example, how as the market floating of price setting took place and on the receipt of the company's first computer, a mathematician working at a New York bond house used the computer to calculate the prices of bonds and even fractions of bonds and began trading on the basis of these calculations. Such calculations connected bonds which were previously traded as separate entities, for instance as 2, 5, and 10-year bonds, a connection which crucially generated opportunities to exploit the relationships between future points in time. In short, such techniques generated profit-making opportunities from temporal relationships. Such practices therefore transformed the very materiality of bonds. Instead of simply moving in and being measured by time, bonds themselves became time. Indeed, such practices transformed bonds from discrete objects moving in time into a continuum of moments. The unfixing of the price of dollars and interest rates therefore created a new relationship between time and phenomena, with the latter, such as bonds, becoming increasingly temporalized and temporalizing. Indeed, in deregulated financial markets, time itself emerged as an object of innovation. So, and contrary to the case of industrial capitalism, where time is money, in deregulated finance markets, money became time. Now, this last point is crucial, for it enables us to see, once again, how the practices of financial traders, as well as of governments and consumers, have not involved a simple trade, commodification, or colonization of pre-existing futures, but rather that these practices related to a shift in time itself. Specifically, in deregulated finance markets, time ceased to operate as an external vessel for practice and increasingly merged with events. And it's in this sense that I think that we find resonances with Bourdieu's understanding of time. For just as Bourdieu insists that time is not a thing in which events take place, that time is not something that simply passes, and that practice is temporalization, in deregulated financial markets, practices and events are both temporalized and temporalize. In short, in deregulated finance market, time increasingly took on the characteristics of the form of time theorized by Bourdieu, to the extent that events and objects, such as bonds, became forms of time, and time itself became an object of innovation, experimentation, and differentiation. So while we might therefore rightly chastise Bourdieu for his lack of attention to the hegemony of clock time for the case of industrial capitalism, and the centrality of this time for the very dynamics of the latter, we find, perhaps ironically, that practice's temporalization offers much purchase for contemporary economic practices, and perhaps even speculate that practice's temporalization may be paradigmatic for post-Fordist regimes of production. But this shift from the hegemony of the clock to practice's temporalization not only, I think, raises challenges to attempts to understand recent economic events via externalist and or normative theories of time, but it also raises a range of more general issues and questions for sociology. It will be recalled, I hope, for example, that Sennett laments the demise of narrative movement, that is, the accumulation of experience and of connections between events in time, and that he demands the reinstallation of a present in which such experience can be sensed. And it will also be recalled, I hope, that Sennett makes this case, especially for the case of economic practice, and he elaborates that in regard to skill, notions of skill. Yet, inasmuch as I have hypothesized here that in economic practice, time and events increasingly unfold together, and that events are not connected in time, but themselves are forms of time, one might question whether or not such an experience is available either to be accumulated or to be sensed. Practice's temporalization, therefore, raises the sociological spectre that experience too may have restructured, a prospect also gestured towards, I think, in Patricia Clough's claim that social life is increasingly unexperienced. That is, it's increasingly beyond human meaning and interpretation, including narrative interpretation. Okay.